Hello, and welcome to this episode of Bite Back Chats Books, where we chat to Jessie Norman. Jessie Norman is primarily the Member of Parliament for Hereford and South Herefordshire, but like one of his main characters in his new book, Jessie is also a philosopher, having received a doctorate from UCL. You may have read his acclaimed biographies of Edmund Burke and Adam Smith, but today we're going to talk about his first ever novel, The Winding Stair. Praised as the perfect sequel to Woeful, The Winding Stair is an epic tale of jealousy and intrigue in Elizabethan and Jacobean England, and a battle fought between two central characters, the philosopher Francis Bacon and the lawyer Edward Coke. The book also holds a darkened mirror to our own contemporary politics, where the same themes of jealousy, intrigue, revenge and betrayal are as evident today as they were in the 16th and 17th century. Jessie, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Nell. Lovely to have a chance to talk.
And we're thrilled to be talking about your new political thriller coming out on the 1st of June. And I think let's start with the epigraph, if that's all right.
Yes.
This is a novel. Much of it's made up. Almost all of it is true. Why was this necessary?
Ah, well, what a great question. I think if you think about historical novels in general, now they tend to be a novel, a plot set in a particular time with a few facts that just anchor it. And when that's done really well, it can be incredibly engrossing and gripping. And I have taken a slightly different approach. I've written a novel which is very, very closely attuned to the history. So you will see the rise and fall of great politicians. You will see executions and religious upheaval and terrible prosecutions and repression and all the rest of it. But you also have that within the context of a novelistic treatment. And what that means is that I don't have to engage with the usual academic arguments. I don't have to include a lot of footnotes and citations. I can include fun dialogue, which kind of enlightens and engages people, and it just gives you lots more freedom. It's much more fun for the reader, and I think, and much more fun for the writer.
And in that way, sort of not letting the fact get in the way of the fiction and sort of running where you want to go with it. What drew you to the Elizabethan Jacobean period in the first place?
Well, the plot is so good, and the story of the conflict between Edward Coke, who's a great titan of the rule of law, the kind of modern founder of the rule of law, and Bacon, who's this extraordinary essayist and philosopher and thinker. The conflict between them is so good that that anchors you automatically at the end of Elizabeth's reign and the reign of James I. So we're in the period 1590 to 1685. And if you think about it, it's a period that's not that much studied by historians because it isn't really the heart of the Tudor period.
Yes.
And it isn't the Civil War. And it's that bit in between. But if you think of it in terms of English literature, it's absolutely fantastic because you've got Shakespeare and John Donne and Herbert and Ben Jonson and Christopher Marlowe. And of course, one of the fun parts of making a novel is I'm able to include a lot of that gorgeous writing from the period as well. And again, I think that just adds to the sense of the time and the hopefully the enjoyment of the reader.
And when did you start researching for this book then?
Well, I've been thinking about the issue for these people and these topics for a long time. The reformal research, I had a fellowship in Oxford in 2016-17, so I started doing some work there So it's been about 6 or 7 years of kind of work, but these things don't always come as quickly as you'd like.
Yeah. And what avenues did you use? I mean, you must have taken you to some brilliant places across the UK.
Yes. I mean, it is fascinating. If you look at their lives. I mean, Coke was the founder of the great fortune that resulted in Holkham Hall and had a magnificent library, one of the greatest libraries of the day, which is still intact at Holkham Hall in the care of the Earl of Leicester. And so I had a chance. Tom Leicester was very kind and invited me up to spend some time there and look at the library. So that was really fun. And then the Marquess of Salisbury was incredibly kind because the Cecil family papers, that's Robert Cecil and his father, William Cecil, Lord Burghley, who basically controlled Elizabethan Jacobean politics for 50 years, those were all at Hatfield House. So I got a chance to go to Hatfield House and talk to those incredible archivists and librarians. And then you know, I spent some time in the Lambeth Palace Library, where there's an awful lot of historical records, and the Inns of Court. I mean, there's just an incredible array of wonderful places associated with these times,
So you've given us a hint of these two main characters, Bacon and Cook. Do you think they were a product of their time or ahead of it?
Well, of course, like all great people, you can anchor them in the past, but then they take you somewhere new. So Cook has a very orthodox legal training, but ends up essentially insisting on a slightly older conception of the law, the idea of an ancient constitution that had come from Anglo-Saxon times, that encoded the freedoms of the true-born English subject. And that, of course, English man, as it almost invariably was thought of in those days. And then Bacon, who also had a legal training, but then went in a completely different direction, became a kind of politician and ultimately Lord Chancellor, and wrote about science and what we would call technology. So in each case, they start from somewhere we understand and we can analyze, and they take us somewhere incredibly new. And of course, when Bacon's writing his essays, the essay is a new form in English. And when he's writing his amazing late story, The New Atlantis, which is like in a utopian fable, that's an incredible change and development itself. And that's before you get into the detail of his thought and Cook's thought, much of which is very challenging and interesting in its own right.
And you explain that with their two Cook's mottos. The prudent man is patient, for he can digest the hardest things, versus Francis's path is to be in the middle. So you can see those dissimilarities there. Would you say there are any real sort of similar?
I mean, that's a very, very interesting contrast. So Cook adopts the image of the ostrich, because the ostrich was famed for being able to chew iron and digest it and still live. And that captures his, you know, tough, resilient, quite brusque, you know, personality. And Bacon, his father's great motto is mediocriter firma, the middle way is the best. And that implies a slightly kind of slithery way through the middle, where you trim in order to achieve what you want to achieve. And Bacon rather incarnated that. And you know, Bacon was compared to a slightly sort of had a viper eye in his own day. And that captures an aspect of it. But of course, these are two different ways of thinking about it. You can try to really knock a problem on the head and you may get a lot of resistance. That's what happened to Cook. Or you can slide and slip your way through politics and through life in order to achieve your outcome. And that's what Bacon did. What is so fascinating about this story is that they both end up basically killing each other in this amazing Mexican standoff. I don't know what it is, but something incredible by the end.
Absolutely. And they're sort of you could say they're a product of their time in the way that learned men really came into their own in the early modern era. We see early on, Elizabeth Parliament, she really struggles with, this is just before the book is set, she struggles with the authority when she's being questioned about her marriage and succession, and calling her lords sort of their bridal colts that do not know their rider's hand, whom bit of kingly rein did never snaffle yet. And reading The Winding Stair, you allude to that in your description of Bacon as a bridal colt. So right early on in the middle and beginning of the book. And we see them sort of challenging authority as we go through. And we see Cook challenging James I's authority. What I'm really asking is, do you think this is the start of a constitutional monarchy in the way of shifting away from that total power, divine right power, with this landed class assuming authority?
So let's start with the first point you raised now, which is about the Queen Elizabeth I, because of course there was, you know, it was an incredibly patriarchal world. There was a natural assumption that monarchs were male, and there was tremendous reluctance to have a female monarch after the death of Henry VIII, and of course the very sudden death of his son Edward VI. So when that happened in the case of Mary, of course, she was a Catholic and came to had a brief and very much later despised reign. And so this did not reinforce people's views that female monarchy was a very good idea. And so when Elizabeth came, she was quite fragile politically. She had to steer her way through all of these competing religious and political factions. And she did it with incredible genius. She was one of the best educated women in history, forget the period. I mean, she's an astounding human being and consistently underestimated. And of course, what's also rather marvelous is that she was, you know, she evidently loved men. She had lots of fantastically able, she didn't feel threatened by them. She loved having talented, strong men around her. And she was very close to Robert Dudley, the Earl of Leicester. Yeah. And, you know, he was someone that she relied on, and there were suggestions they might even have been lovers. I'm not sure that's true, but there was that feeling that she was able to take control of her own destiny as queen in a way that they all recognized, and that she acted through these men rather than being dominated by them. But there were certainly moments where if you'd asked Burleigh, you know, he would have said, well, I think I can get the queen where I need her to be to do whatever it is we need to do. Yeah. And there are moments when he deceives and notably on the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots, the queen is deceived in order to achieve an end of state, or she's semi-deceived. She kind of, there may be a case that she actually knows what's going on, but wants some deniability. Anyway, when you get to the later period, I think it's really important not to read back too much. By the end of the 17th century, you have the Glorious Revolution. You have this new concept of the king in parliament.
Yeah.
And that's because one way of reading the 17th century is that, you know, Britain tried to have a period of personal reign by the monarch. Well, that didn't work very well. Charles got his head cut off. And then it had a period of rule by parliament, and that didn't work very well. And then it had a period of rule by the army, and that didn't work very well. So the restoration in 1660 is a kind of recognition that actually, at the end of the day, some variety of monarchy was preferable to the chaos and disorder of the civil wars, of which, as you will know, there were essentially several. And by the time you get to 1688, which is nearly 30 years after the restoration, you've gone through the whole problem of a potential Catholic monarchy with James II. And people are ready for a new dispensation. They want a Protestant king, bring them in, put them under some control. And that's where that constitutional monarchy comes from. But there's no doubt that when Cook is presenting his view of the common law and saying, in terms, the king is under the law, not the law under the king, he's articulating ancient ideas that recognize the king's status as it were, the authority, the supreme authority of, at least in temporal matters, of law, but also encase him in a legal framework. And that feels very like the preliminary to a constitutional rule of law set up, as it were, antecedent to the one we have today.
Yeah. With the other epigraph at the end, you include Prospero's speech. As you were saying earlier, it's great to include some of the amazing literature. His final speech about sacrificing his staff and his magic and his books. Why did you include this?
Well, I don't think it would be right to let daylight in upon the creative process of writing a novel now, But one of the things that is doing is it's looking forward to the arguments that occur around Francis Bacon with thinking about technology, with thinking about the way in which man can or should, or human beings can or should control their world and their environment. Bacon was aware of those drawbacks. Bacon had an acute understanding that technology could go wrong. And he also has this incredible sense, which you find in The Tempest, of a kind of utopian island. And when he writes about the New Atlantis towards the very end of his life, 1623, which is a kind of utopian imagination of what a society, an idealized society, would be like based on science and reason, then he's kind of picking out what's in the air about new frontiers. And that's, of course, a world of exploration that's being undertaken in the Pacific, the search for routes to China, and also thinking about the frontiers of the mind. And so it's quite an interesting debate to put those two next to each other and think about how they relate to each other.
Definitely. And you're in quite a unique position in this, that you're a sitting member of parliament and you can see the action happening right in front of you. And this is also a political thriller novel. There are a lot of ambitious characters in The Winding Stair.
Yes.
And from your viewpoint, are there any particular similarities you can draw to today's political scene between the characters and some of those people?
It's a parlor game, isn't it? It's James the First, really, the Boris Johnson of the 17th century. I mean, I'm not gonna opine on that, but because it's a novel, you read into it what you want to read. But what I think is interesting is the forms of behavior. So
you get,
we've just seen a famous example of Dominic Cummings driving a wedge between the Prime Minister and his Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Yes.
And that's very, Francis Bacon is quite careful to drive a wedge between his rival Cook and the King. That's a very similar thing. We've seen a period of kind of squabbling factions during the Brexit period because there'd been a loss of central authority, and that feels quite like some of the period after the election of 2017, when some of the power of the government ebbed away and people started to come out. So you can find these everywhere. And of course, the themes of jealousy, revenge, intrigue, and betrayal are kind of sempiternal. It continues in politics and have been ever since people have lived in political societies.
Nothing changes, does it?
It just takes different forms. I mean, the same angers tend to work themselves, or rage, or disagreement, or jealousy, or these emotions work themselves out in human behaviour.
And I suppose another angle is the royal side of it. I mean, we're at a unique position again, where we've now just sadly lost Queen Elizabeth II and have King Charles III. Might be interesting for the readers to look at sort of the shift in monarchy from female to male. But obviously it was more acute then. But
it's such a good point. Of course, you have the shift in the book between Elizabeth I as she was in the 1590s and early 1600s. And very much withdrawn into herself, not the force that she'd been, on the shore of Tilbury at the time of the Spanish Armada, and people jockeying around her for power. And then James comes in. It's quite different from now, because there was a sense of universal mourning. I was very much involved in some of the memorial and the mourning period around her funeral.
Yeah.
And as a minister in the Foreign Office, one of my jobs was to greet all these dignitaries who'd come in to attend the funeral. And of course, there hasn't been the same sense of kind of joyous relief with the new king, because everyone loved Elizabeth the second so much. But with James, there was a definite sense that perhaps politics could restart. And of course, a lot of people, Elizabeth I, her enormous credit, was quite stingy when it came to handing out money and honours. And so everyone was hoping that, they'd get their knighthoods or their monopolies extended or granted by James. And so when James comes and starts, scattering these honours like baubles and confetti at a very lavish funeral, everyone's absolutely delighted. And of course, he brings with him very, very free spending habits, and that creates problems. And again, that imposes all kinds of strains into which the plot, they have an effect on the plot as well, because the king's perennially short of money.
So would you say that's a bit of a crux point in the novel, the death of Elizabeth and sort of everyone rushing to James's heel?
Yes, I mean, there's an enormous amount of, it's not quite clear who's going to succeed, and the betting is that it'll be James, but they weren't quite sure. Once James has been made the king, or has become the king, has succeeded and been, as it were, recognized as such, and even before his coronation, the crowd, all of the great nobles in England in particular, don't forget, he's already been the Scottish king, so that's not new for them. But in England, they're all very much trying to get their head around who the king is and, what does he want and how can we please him? And, he's got a fondness for attractive young men. So, of course, all the great houses of England are ransacking their further junior relations for these young men they can send to the court.
Yeah. Brilliant. I mean, I feel like there's so much we could get into with the book, but one thought I had is, if you could develop a character further, if any, who would it be? And sort of imagine a spin-off series.
Well, that's such a good question. We've talked a lot about the men involved, you know, Cook, Bacon, Cecil, Burley, Lester. But of course, the women are absolutely fantastic at this time as well. You've got Elizabeth, you've got the mother of Francis Bacon, Lady Anne Bacon, probably the second most well-educated woman in England, along with her sister Mildred. It's astonishing, Cook sisters. And they, a different cook, I should say, not Edward Cook, but a different cook. And Lady Bacon is fantastic. She's constantly, you know, upbraiding Francis for getting into too much debt and, you know, failing to live in a thrifty and suitably Christian, pious way. She's very funny. She writes these horrendous kind of hectoring letters that everyone will get behind. And then you have this extraordinary character who is Cook's second wife. Edward Cook marries first a woman of whom we know very little, with Bridget Paston, except that she was a very loving wife to Cook. But he then marries, in short order, and indeed comes into conflict with Bacon over it. Another, their rivalry is not just about power, position, place, influence. It's also about a woman.
Old school women fighting.
Matters of the heart, exactly. And this is Eliza Hatton. And Eliza Hatton was, you know, literally the most beautiful, the best connected, and one of the richest women in England, and very young.
Yeah.
Because her husband had died when she was only been in her marriage for a few years. And people, young women married very early in those days. So she gets married to Cook. And of course, it looks like this marvelous combination of kind of brains and masculinity and kind of beauty in a very kind of conventional terms. But of course, she's fantastic. She's incredibly clever, high energy, spirited. She's not putting up with being patronized by some like Cook. And they fall out because she insists on having her prerogative over her own money. She's not going to be owned by her husband. She's not going to have her property completely controlled by him. And then they then fight, they have a huge fight over the fate of their daughter, Frances, who, I won't spoil the plot too much, but there's a moment where Cook finds himself out of sorts, and he takes some pretty desperate measures to get himself back into favor with the king, and that brings him into fight. So the person I'd love to develop more, and we don't know enough about, is Eliza Hatton. She's absolutely fantastic, and you know, a kind of Bridgerton spin-off, which focuses on these marvelous women, would be just fantastically funny and good.
Yeah, that'd be great. Really, so if on that note, who would you get to play Bacon and Cook in a dramatization?
I mean, it's, you know, what age, I suppose, in their pomp. I mean, you want a tough, strong figure to play Cook. I want Dominic West to play Cook and Damian Lewis to play Bacon.
Oh yeah, that'd be good telly. Yeah.
How about that? That kind of gets things going. And then we could have Kate Winslet playing Eliza or something. Yeah. I don't know. I'm just, you know, I'm not sure the timing's quite right. Yeah. We might have to go kind of Lily
that sounds great.
Someone for Eliza. But you know, we can see that.
I can see it now. And if you could be a fly on the wall in any of the scenes in the book, which one would you choose?
I mean, it's horrible for me to say this, but so many great scenes. There's a series of standoffs between Cook and the king, and moments of conflict between Cook and Bacon, and then these incredible trials. There's the trial of Essex, who, you know,
runs a rebellion,
has his head cut off. There's the trial of the gunpowder prisoners, which Cook runs. You know, the gunpowder treasoners who are trying to blow up everyone. I think there's an incredible moment in 1608 where Cook nearly comes to blows with the king. The king nearly hits Cook. He's so angry with him of something he's said. And I mean, I think that would have to be right up there as one of those moments, because, you know, you don't often see a king raise his hand against an ordinary subject.
Great scene to pick there, I think. Well, Jesse, thank you for answering some of my more peculiar questions towards the end.
Not at all.
And we're very excited for the book's releases on the 1st of June, The Winding Stair. Thank you for coming on the podcast today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Nell.
Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Bite Back podcast. The Winding Stair is out on the 1st of June. Head to the Bite Back website to use exclusive 20% off code TWS20. And whilst you're there, dive into some of our online Q&As with authors. And do get in touch with us on Twitter with your questions or queries at Bite Back Pub.